If ever there were a place where the public might embrace the rationing of healthcare, that place would be Britain.
Household milks here again, and this is the tin. One for each ration book every 8 weeks.
During World War II and for 9 years after, the British government rationed most food items on a weekly basis.
Your basic ration was this very small lump of meat. Flour was rationed, but it was available, but eggs were not available. You'd get one egg a month.
This is my mom, Jane Cox. She was a child during the war, a child who could only dream of lavish cakes and desserts. And it wasn't just food that was rationed. The government strictly controlled the supply of gasoline, soap, stockings, even the number of buttons on jackets. There was wartime rationing in the United States too, but only for 3 years, and only for a few items. It was quickly forgotten. In contrast, rationing in Britain became part of the national identity. My mother is among many who still speak of rationing as a great legacy of those wartime and post-war years when people sacrificed their own interest for the greater good.
It's a good idea because you're sharing it, and people don't resent things when everybody is sharing. You see, it was fair. It was very fair. It was rational.
After World War II, the British government applied the values of rationing to healthcare. It created the National Health Service, the NHS.
This new health service will be organised on a national scale as a public responsibility. The cost of the service will be met from rates, taxes, and national insurance, and so everyone will pay for it.
Thought was a catch in it.
And everyone will benefit from it. When you're ill, you won't have to pay for treatment.
Much has changed in the past 5.5 decades, but today that basic social compact remains in place.
We have a limited budget for healthcare, voted by Parliament every year, and we have to live within our means.
This is Michael Rawlins. He heads a much-talked-about agency that decides which drugs and other treatments can be prescribed by NHS doctors. It's called the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, or for short, NICE. Rawlins says NICE came into being in 1999 in order to let the public in on why certain drugs are approved and others rejected.
In the old days, it used to be done in secret, behind closed doors, smoke-filled rooms, and nobody was really aware of what was happening. Now, it's explicit, and everybody knows what the rules are, what the decisions are, and I think that's right. People should understand.
NICE's rationing decisions start with a basic premise. The government should spend its limited resources on treatments that do the most good for the money.
We take cost-effectiveness into account.
And NICE calculates cost-effectiveness using a widely used measure called a quality-adjusted life year. In each case, NICE asks these questions. How much does a drug or procedure cost? How much does the treatment extend the average patient's life? And what is the quality of that life gained? The calculations are hugely complicated, but in essence, this is how it works. Imagine that a cancer treatment costs $100,000. And imagine that it extends the life of the average patient by 4 years. That means the cost of the treatment per year gained is $25,000. But now imagine that for part of those 4 years, the patient will be in pain and bedridden. So NICE might figure the quality of that life at 50% of perfect health, which under NICE's formula would make the drug half as cost-effective. In other words, $50,000 per quality-adjusted year. NICE has a maximum that it'll spend on a treatment, a threshold, as Michael Rawlins puts it. It's just over $47,000 per quality-adjusted year gained.
And if we up the thresholds that we currently use, something else, somewhere else in the system is going to have to give. It's a finite pot of money. It's not infinite.
NICE considers most common treatments to be cost-effective. Insulin for diabetes, cholesterol-lowering drugs for heart disease, kidney transplants. What it does not consider cost-effective are some of the more expensive drugs meant to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease or some cancers, and therefore it says the NHS shouldn't pay for them. This is rationing by cold, hard logic. Unsentimental? Yes, says Michael Rawlins. But also, he says, compassionate, even if it means denying some patients drugs that might keep them alive for a few extra months.
We do recognise that the end of life is a very special time. We do recognise that two, three, four, five, 6 months may be very precious, allows people to attend weddings, see a grandchild or great-grandchild born, make forgivenesses, receive forgivenesses. It is a very special time. We understand that. The problem is that if we spend a lot of money that way, we're going to have to deprive other people of cost-effective care. And it's worth remembering that there are lots of other things we could do with our money and would might well have a bigger impact. Just to give you one example, our infant mortality rates are about 5 per 1,000. That is, 5 babies per 1,000 die in the first year of life. Most of it is preventable. And in Finland, it's 2 per 1,000. So we're having 3 extra babies dying each year per 1,000 babies born. Now, that's an awful lot of babies dying unnecessarily.
Imagine for one moment how I feel when I hear people saying that if they give me the drugs I need to stay alive, babies are dying. Now, how do I feel?
This is David Cook. He's one of a growing number of cancer patients who've been speaking out against NICE. The way they see it, the rationing agency's logic breaks down when you go from the abstract formula to specific patients like Cook. David Cook tells me his story as he sips strong English tea in his village farmhouse kitchen. He's in his 50s, a senior government manager, not, he hastens to add, in the healthcare sector. In 2004, he was diagnosed with kidney cancer. 2 years later, his prognosis was bad. His doctor said he would die within months unless he got a drug to slow the growth of his tumours. But the cost was high, too high for NICE in light of the advanced stage of Cook's cancer. NICE's rationing formula excluded the drug. The formula, though, is based on the average patient. Individual patients might do better on a given treatment, which would make the drug more cost-effective than NICE suggests. Cook's doctor believed that was true for him. And so Cook pleaded his case before a panel of experts.
I went to appeal, and essentially I had to persuade a total of 6 people that were in the room. I had to talk for my life.
Cook won his appeal. He got the drug, though he resents the fact that he had to fight for it and that he was treated as an exception. He has another complaint about NICE. He says it portrays itself as equitable, treating all patients the same. But he contends that's not really true. He says NICE is more likely to reject drugs for rarer cancers like his because the treatments are more expensive than those for, say, breast cancer or lung cancer.
With the more common cancers, there are lots of treatments available. For us, there isn't. And so, actually, we're being penalised for having, if you like, the wrong type of cancer.
And there's another area where Cook believes that NICE has overreached. That's in measuring the quality of a patient's life. Bureaucrats, he says, shouldn't decide that the life of a bedridden patient, for instance, is worth a quarter or a half that of someone in perfect health. And he says NICE neglects to factor in how, by living longer, a patient may improve the quality of loved ones' lives. For his part, Cook is still active and working. He hasn't just attended weddings and sought forgivenesses.
I've done a bit more than that. I've supported my family. In this time, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. I've taken her through... I'm sorry, I get upset. I get upset every time that I have to discuss that or it comes into my mind. And I've had to take her through a year of hell, through chemotherapy, through radiotherapy, through all the treatment, the worry. And both of my children, within a very short space of time, could have lost both of their parents. 4 years on, I'm still here, and I can tell you now that I intend to be here in 4 years' time if I can get access to these drugs.
Stories like David Cook's about the government restricting access to life-saving drugs have become common in the British media. Part of the reason is that so many new cancer drugs have become available in the last few years. Drugs like the ones that David Cook was initially denied. Many of these treatments are extremely expensive, and NICE's rejection of some of them has fueled a growing backlash against the agency. Patient groups and drug companies have called it heartless and indiscriminate. NICE's future now hangs in the balance. This year, the ruling Labour Party, which founded the agency, lost a general election. The new Conservative-led government has now said it'll pay for some cancer drugs turned down by NICE. It's established a cancer fund that will total more than $300 million a year. This comes at a time of economic crisis in Britain. The government is making huge cuts in just about every other public service. Health economist Alan Maynard of the University of York says setting up a cancer fund may seem compassionate, but it undermines NICE, just when the country needs to be reminded of the value of rationing.
It's a very curious, mostly political decision. I mean, why should you discriminate in favour of cancer patients rather than mental illness patients or people with heart disease or other conditions? So it's an attempt, really, to put money into the cancer area, partly in response to the demands of patients and the pharmaceutical industry.
These days in Britain, few speak favourably about an agency that was set up to ensure that the government could provide the best care to the most people.
NICE is not very popular. I am a big fan of it, but I may be the only fan of NICE in the country. After all, it's the organization that says no.
Lionel Shriver is a writer, an American who lives in London. She's been closely following the debate over healthcare rationing. Shriver's latest novel, So Much for That, is about the US healthcare system, how, in her view, it failed a woman who was dying of cancer. I asked Shriver if she'd been writing about the British healthcare system, would her novel have turned out differently?
Drastically. The character in the book, whose illness is central, has mesothelioma. That's a rare but deadly disease, which is caused almost always by exposure to asbestos. It is incurable. Now, in the United States, that doesn't stop people from trying to cure it anyway. A close friend of mine who helped to inspire this story got mesothelioma, and she lived a year and 3 months after diagnosis. And she died anyway. And her treatment, in the meantime, cost $2 million. If she had been in the UK, that character would have been given palliative care alone. They would have tried to keep her comfortable and out of pain. But they would have skipped the major surgery. They would have skipped all that excruciating chemotherapy. And I have to say that given that the verdict was terminal anyway, I think that my character and indeed my friend would have been better off in the United Kingdom, would have had a more dignified last few months of her life, would have been in less pain since most of the suffering was caused by the treatment.
Others agree that the British approach to treatment may be both humane and efficient. A steady stream of healthcare officials from countries like Brazil, China, and Poland have visited to see if setting up a rationing agency along the lines of NICE makes sense. Some American healthcare experts wanted to establish an agency like NICE in the US, but that didn't pan out after Sarah Palin cited Britain as the inspiration for what she claimed was an Obama administration plan for so-called death panels. In this year's healthcare reform law, Congress specifically prohibited British-style rationing, which means that Medicare, for example, cannot apply quality-of-life tests in determining the cost-effectiveness of treatments. Too bad, says Lionel Shriver. She says Americans still don't seem ready to focus on some key end-of-life questions.
At least in the UK, we're having the conversation. How much is a life worth? And what kind of quality of life is that? It's not just, are you going to live, but are you going to be living in bed? You know, are you going to be semi-conscious? Are you going to be in pain? I appreciate that we are addressing this here.
But as other countries look to Britain as a model, it's far from clear that the model itself will survive. And that begs the question, can explicit healthcare rationing work anywhere if it's in trouble in the very country that may be best equipped to take it on? For The World, I'm Patrick Cox, London.